Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, offering new and used vehicles to help Mainers explore the beauty of their home state. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's chief political correspondent Steve Missler and senior political reporter Mal Leary. The Postal Service as political football. Postal workers continue to express their concerns. Maine Congresswoman Shelley Pingree was talking about chicks so slowed in delivery that nearly 5,000 of them have arrived dead in Maine in recent weeks. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has been on Capitol Hill this week, defending his cuts and reorganization as necessary steps, some of which predated his tenure. But he has suspended more changes until Election Day and has been trying to assure Congress the Postal Service can handle the expected flood of mailed-in ballots. Steve, Mal, any sign our congressional delegation is reassured by what DeJoy has been saying?
I really don't think they are, Erwin. In fact, Congresswoman Pingree told me flat out that promises aren't good enough. And she wants the postmaster to be supporting the additional appropriation that's coming before the House over the weekend, some $25 billion that is needed to keep the place solvent over the next year or so. In fact, you know, it's bipartisan. Senator Collins has said the same thing. She's co-sponsoring that bill on the Senate side that would provide the $25 billion. I think they're listening to what his promises are, and I've been watching part of the hearing that are underway before the Senate Homeland Security Committee. And, you know, the questions are tough from both parties, basically telling the Postmaster General, can he look in the camera to all those people watching around the world on cable news networks around the country and assure them that, yes, indeed, everything's going to work come Election Day. And he's been pretty hard pressed by questions.
Well, let's start at the beginning. I mean, the USPS was born out of a fight, the American Revolution, and more specifically, colonists' desire for the free distribution of letters and newspapers critical of the British Crown. And now it's front and center of a presidential election that some view as a battle for the fate of the same republic that the Postal Service helped create, right? So, you know, we saw this week that it has an impact on a very important U.S. Senate race between Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins and her Democratic challenger, Sarah Gideon. The other two candidates, the independents, have not gotten involved in this too deeply at the moment, although I think Lisa Savage has maybe made some statements about it, but not quite the same way that Sarah Gideon did this week when she went to one of the postal unions in Portland and, you know, stood there alongside of postal workers and basically called out Senator Collins for a 2006 bill that some argue is contributing to the Postal Service's financial problems. And some believe has given DeJoy cover to make some of these dramatic cost-cutting measures that have gotten him on the hot seat today. So there's a lot of history with that bill, but you know, I think it just at the end of the day, it underscores just how hot button of an issue the Postal Service really is, especially in a state like Maine, a rural state where people are very much dependent on the delivery of mail and the timely delivery of mail because in some instances, it's chicks going to farmers or it's medications going to people who don't really want to spend a lot of time out and about at drugstores because of COVID. It'll be interesting to see how Senator Collins in particular reacts to DeJoy's testimony over the weekend. She has a lot riding on this in no small part because of that 2006 bill.
Let me ask you guys this. You know, the post office, of course, used to be a federal department. And at some point, Congress attempted to put some distance. So you now have the U.S. Postal Service. You have a board of governors that runs it. Does Congress still have the full ability to control what the post office does?
They created it. So they have the ultimate control to make changes, but it would take an action of Congress to do it. I mean, that's the difference that we're talking about here. It's sort of like the situation we had here in Maine with the recent Supreme Court decision concerning the delegation of the regulatory authority over utilities to the PUC by the legislature. Once the legislature did it, then it's over there in the regulatory agency. That doesn't mean you can't change the law. And I think what we're seeing here is Congress is coming in saying, we got to take a little bit more of an active role here. And that includes giving them some more money, because quite frankly, the system has not been able to pay for itself. And as Steve pointed out quite rightly, that 2006 law on paying forward the health insurance portion of retirement benefits is a big deal. No private companies are stuck with that kind of a requirement. Not that it's not good fiscal sense in terms of just looking at it that way, but you know, things in Washington are not necessarily by good fiscal sense.
Yeah, and the other thing too, Erwin, I would just add to what Mal said, because I think it's important. There's a lot of people who have a lot of opinions about the Postal Service and how it's been viewed and overhauled by Congress over the years. And I think there's a tendency to view the Postal Service through the lens of private enterprise. There's a focus on its balance sheet and its ability to pay its bills and whether it makes any money. You know, the whole profit margin issue that seems to be one of the big impetus for DeJoy's changes that he's implementing. But there are a lot of people who believe it just shouldn't be viewed that way. It should be viewed as a civic entity, a public service. But it really hasn't been viewed that way over the years. And perhaps this crisis will change that thinking a little bit.
That was one of the thinkings, I believe, behind the change, making it no longer a department of government, but placing it over here, you know, where you could separate out the finances. All right, Democrats held their first virtual convention this week. First thing I want to do is ask each of you, what did you think?
I have a lot of thoughts about it, actually. One of them is that it was, you know, it was disjointed, it was strange, and it just kind of felt lonely at times. And, you know, there was technical glitches. I mean, watching it on PBS was quite the experience. But at the same time, that kind of feels like a decent representation of American life these days during the pandemic, you know. And I think the other thing that the convention did, and it was quite successful, is that it was an event, almost a national mourning about what's going on with the pandemic that we really haven't had a chance to have. You know, we've been so apart and distant, and there's been no big gatherings of any sort. The convention did, I think, serve that role. And I think there was some good moments too, and some changes that we might see going forward, including the delegate roll call that we've, you know, there's always been sort of this, you know, in recent conventions, you know, over the last, say, decade or two, kind of a pro forma event, not really that interesting, you know, because it's happening on a crowded and noisy convention floor. But the way they did it this year, where each state and the territories would have somebody just do a 30-second video, you know, Rhode Island did one where, you know, there was one guy, very enthusiastic delegate, standing beside a person who was masked and a very large man holding a mountain of greasy fried squid, you know, calamari, which is a Rhode Island specialty. And that was kind of cool, even though if it was a little bit hokey, you know. And then of course in Maine, we had Craig Hickman get up and talk about how he's living the American dream. And, you know, Erwin, you did a great interview with him about that. And it was cool. I would not be surprised if they bring that type of thing back. As an observer, as someone who didn't have to actually cover it, I kind of liked it in spots. I mean, there were some spots that were not that great, but it was interesting for sure.
I thought it was dramatically different. I've covered several national conventions, and the energy and enthusiasm that you get from having all of those 15,000 Republicans or 15,000 Democrats crowded into one auditorium is something that's very hard to express. I mean, you could do it. I remember trying to do a couple of live shots from the floor of the conventions, and the noise is so loud, it's very, very difficult to do because there's so much energy and so much excitement. That's the part that we lost by this new mechanism. But I agree with Steve. Some of the things they did were excellent. I thought the opening was particularly excellent with the shots of the singers, mostly school kids from across the country, forming into this huge map of the United States. I mean, it was great. And those are the sorts of things I think they should carry over. But I really think you're going to see them go back to some semblance of the old one too, because, you know, the stories of those conventions are rife. I can't begin to tell you the amount of stories I got covering those conventions, including an impromptu interview with President Reagan behind the stage at the Dallas convention that just happened. And the guy just stopped. We talked about Maine and Maine politics for 10 minutes. And it was one of those stories that was a big deal back here. Couldn't get it when you're doing everything virtually because you'd be going through 20 sets of handlers to set up the interview.
Then you miss the parades of delegates carrying their stanchions through the convention hall.
But, and their wonderful hats.
And the wonderful hats.
Don't forget the hats.
You know, just one quick follow-up on Craig Hickman, who did get to do the roll call of the states for Maine. He did tell me that several other people were under consideration for that as well. Anybody want to venture a guess as to why Hickman was chosen to represent the state?
I'll guess that it's because he's an emblem of inclusion in the Democratic Party. You know, he is openly gay and he's also a black man. For him to stand up there and talk about how his business is doing so great and he's living the American dream with his husband out in this bucolic setting in Winthrop, that really caught on too. I don't know if you guys noticed these social media attention, but it was pretty significant. And I think I made this crack in the newsletter that, you know, I think Craig Hickman did a better job of making Maine a destination in 30 seconds than the Maine Office of Tourism will do with $2 million, you know, which is what they're spending right now to get tourists here during the pandemic. And I don't know if that was the motivation by the Democrats, but it certainly could be the effect.
The state Senate is coming back into session to vote on some nominations now. Will these legislators be able to or doing anything other than holding these confirmation votes?
Well, not officially. The only thing they can do under the Constitution when they're in is deal with the nominations that are on the table, which are things like the Gambling Control Board and a district court judge. So they have to deal with those, but that doesn't mean they won't be politics involved. I suspect you're going to have a lot of politicking around the edges among the senators, particularly on the question of calling themselves back into session and that whole flap. And you know, the reality is the Republicans will push their position that a special session for limited purposes for certain bills of importance is all right, but not to open it up to consider 200 and I forget the number we're up to now of bills that have been reported out of committee during the summer. Just think about the potential of how much time it would take to deal with those bills. And I think that's one of the big concerns. So the short answer is what they can do formally is limited, but what will be going on informally is not.
All right. Steve, you're going to be producing a new political newsletter. Tell us about that and maybe what people can look for in the first edition.
Every week, I basically write up a note of things I've noticed throughout the week and things that might be coming down the pipe next week. We got to thinking that, look, you know, why not refine that and send it out to people by way of a newsletter? Because I think there's some people who listen to the podcast and might want to reference something that we talk about. And it's hard to do that when, you know, our voices go out over radio or in some cases, a digital stream. So this is basically almost a written record of what we will sometimes talk about on this podcast. You know, I think and I hope that people will enjoy it because it's really meant to be a companion for the podcast. Not everything that's in the podcast will be in the newsletter and vice versa. And this week, for example, we didn't talk about it, but I'll just mention it. I took a look briefly at some of the ads that have been running in the 2nd Congressional District. Pretty sleepy race at the moment, but it's not going to be, I suspect, given that Republicans believe that that's a flippable seat. But Jared Golden, the Democratic incumbent, has been running some really good ads and the best ones, just like in 2018 when he ran and took the seat, have involved his wife, Isabel. You know, I think that in some ways she is a bit of a secret weapon, maybe not so secret weapon now, as we sort of gird for what is inevitably going to be a lot of nasty attacks over, you know, the next few weeks.
Steve Missler, our chief political correspondent, Mallory, our senior political correspondent. Thank you guys once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maine's Political Pulse, the podcast, is updated on Friday afternoons. You can hear most of it on Weekend Edition Sunday on Maine Public Radio. We have some excerpts on Morning Edition on Monday mornings as well. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. We'll talk with you again soon.